If you want to bring about social change, you have to invest in us. You have to invest in us because we are social innovators and that we know how to create the sort of organized change that you're looking at.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
Welcome to Haymarket House. My name is Rory Fanning, and I have had the distinct pleasure of working on publicity for Occupation Organizer, and I can personally attest that everybody who has read this book considers it an unbelievable resource and tool. But before we get started, I would just like to encourage everybody to wear a mask while when they're in the audience. I would also like to thank In These Times for co-sponsoring this event. Books will be on sale afterwards, and Clément will be signing afterwards, so you can get his autograph. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Alex and Clément.
All right, thanks Rory, and thanks everyone. My name is Alex Hahn, and I'm the executive director of In These Times magazine. I'm also a longtime union and community organizer based here in Chicago, and really excited to discuss this book today. I want to ask Clément to introduce himself, and we'll start out with Clément giving a rundown of the book, kind of giving a sense of what we're going to be talking about. I've got a set of questions prepared for him, and then we want to give space for people in the audience if you have questions. Think about those, and without further ado, I'll now hand it over to Clément Petitjean.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming here. I'm really excited to be presenting this book. So I arrived like a week ago from Paris, which is where I live, and this is my first time in Chicago since 2018 because of COVID and everything. So I'm really glad that I have the opportunity to talk about the book. Before I sort of talk about what's in the book, I just want to really say thank you to Haymarket for making this possible, and for John, Katie, Rory, Rachel, who else worked on the book? Michael and Aaron, because this is something that people might not know, but writing a book really is a collective experience. In the end, you just have like the author's name on it, but you know, all the edits and the publicity, all of that really is something that is collective, and I'm glad that I'm doing it for such an amazing publisher. So I want to start with kind of explaining, or maybe like saying a few words about why it is, I think, important that I'm coming to this particular topic from a French perspective, or at least from a non-American perspective. And sort of given the movement that has been going on in France for the past couple of months. So you can date it back to mid-January of this year, but really like some years before of, you know, people being pretty angry with our president and his government. This movement has sort of taken as its main focus a pension reform plan that has hiked the retirement age from 62 to 64, and you have seen this pretty unprecedented level of anger and unrest that has not stopped, contrary to what a lot of people might have expected. You know, unrest is still going on. May 1st, tomorrow, will very likely be a huge moment of collective action and protest. And what is striking when you sort of look at it from a non-French perspective is the lack of an organizer's role very often in protests. And this is something that I've experienced with my colleagues, trying to sort of use the stuff that I had studied in Chicago for my PhD. So I worked on community organizing in Chicago between like 2015 and 2018. And when I was trying to have this sort of intentionality in building relationships, there was a lot of pushback from my colleagues and comrades. Like, so sort of trying to transfer the organizer's role in France does not really work because the existing institutions' history of organizing practices are not exactly the same. So when you think about that and you sort of go back to the US, what I'm trying to show in this book is that it's sort of how the organizer's role has been built historically, going back to Saul Alinsky, but also arguing that really it goes beyond Alinsky, and that the idea that it has emerged as a profession, so both something that people can live off, but also live for, that moment really emerges in the 1970s and 80s, at a point where you have a lot of movement radicals, so people who got involved in the civil rights movement, in the anti-war movement, in the feminist movement, in Black Power movement, who are trying to sort of find ways to keep being engaged sort of politically in a pretty broad sense. And that happened at the moment when sort of solution to that was building an occupation, building a group of cadre, building a group of skilled practitioners who could keep protest happening in this moment of movement flowing back and of kind of, this sort of neoliberal counter-revolution and conservative revolution in the 1980s. And so the idea is to sort of bringing historical perspective to this occupation, which very often does not think about its history and is very much focused on sort of pragmatic take on politics. It's like, okay, you have to look at numbers, you have to look at who's going to show up, you have to think about turnout, you have to think about building relationships with people. And that pragmatic bent has a history that I talk about in the book, and that history also shapes the work. What I'm arguing is that you can look at it from sort of tension between two poles in a continuum. One of them would be what I call a sort of political cranberry egg, so something that has a lot of radicalism in the rhetoric and in the narrative, but is sort of layered on top of pretty mild liberal politics, so liberal pluralism, class harmony, and then a belief in the institutions of representative democracy. And that emerges through Saul Alinsky's work and career from the 1940s to the 1970s. And then on the other hand, you have what I call spade work, which emerges in the wake of Ella Baker's work in Mississippi and in the South, and then SNCC, some parts of SDS, the Black Panthers, and other other radical groups in that era, and these two traditions sort of coming together in the late 70s and 80s and giving birth to this to the group. And so you have this tension between the Alinsky side, which looks also like management consulting, and radical spade work, which emerges from radical pedagogy. And the argument I'm making is that these two are like inseparable. So you can work in the spade work tradition, but you still have in the daily practices that you do the element of management and consulting that is sort of built into the work. And conversely, when you work on that sort of managerial outside expert part of the equation, you still have the possibility for spade work that is also built into the work. And I think it helps to think about the contradictions and the fundamental ambiguity and ambivalence of the organizing role, which is, I think, kind of the main insight from the work, is that it works under a number of constraints. There's this structural subordination to the philanthropic field. There's a sort of very interesting, sort of conflicted relationship with the electoral arena. And then you have very interesting competition with social movements. So on the one hand, community-based organizations using the same rhetoric, talking about the same issues in terms of social justice, racial justice, economic justice, but at the same time, looking at the work from a professional perspective. And what I mean by that is having what sociologists would say sort of sense of cognitive superiority. Like, we know how to create a campaign. We know how to win policy change. And then we as organizers know how to do that. And then the activists don't. The activists are ineffective. They don't have a base. They don't know how to build and expand a base. And that organizer-activist distinction, which must feel very natural to a lot of you, felt just so weird to me when I heard it the first time. Because thinking from a French perspective is like, in French, there's only one word to describe that, which would be militant or militante if you're talking about a woman. And it was like, what is this distinction? What does it mean? How come the people I talk to for my field work, how come they would feel offended enough if I call them activists? And how come there's so much pride in them saying, we are organizers, we are not activists? So the answer I come up with is that you have this amateur professional divide that does, in my opinion, explain a lot of these dynamics. And the last thing I do want to point out before we get to questions with Alex is that this professionalization does not necessarily imply depoliticization. So it's not because you have folks working as full-time organizers and making a living out of it that it sort of gives less value to their work, and that volunteer engagement, volunteer commitment would be more real or more authentic because it presupposes a lot of stuff that we can talk about in the discussion, but also it fails to acknowledge the fact that people holding organizer positions can also be radicalized and politicized by the very fact of working as organizers. So depending on if you look at the organizational level, at the occupational level, or at the individual level, you see different outcomes, and hence the idea that I want to bring to the general current discussion in this country, that this is ambivalent for very positive and negative reasons and perspectives.
All right, thank you, Clément. I want to jump into a few questions. Again, we'll take some questions from the audience when we're done. I want to go back to the question of the current protests happening in France and dig into that a little bit more and hear from you a little bit. I mean, you kind of raised that you've been trying to raise different tactics and strategies that you've learned in your research, and that hasn't necessarily been well received. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you view those protests, given your research and understanding of organizing in the United States, in Chicago in particular, if you think there are specific lessons that can be learned either way, vis-a-vis, this current moment.
Yeah, that's tough.
And we could spend maybe an hour talking about this question. So,
so I write more about this in a piece I recently wrote for Jacobin, but I'll try to be synthetic here. What I think is interesting when you look at the French protests is that all of it has developed without there being institutionalized organizers' roles that could have led to this happening. So the first thing is, I don't want to say it happened spontaneously because it didn't. It happened through a lot of union organizing. It happened through stuff that political organizations would do, as well as associations like ATTAC, which would be kind of a nonprofit here, have done as well. So you do have this sort of institutional nexus that has tried to go toe-to-toe with Macron. A bunch of academics as well have played an important role in showing the blatant lies that the government has tried to ram onto the general public. And what also interested me is that, so in the university I tried to, we did stuff with some of my colleagues, and I had all the stuff I heard and studied in mind, okay, how do you build like bigger turnout to the next to general meeting in your department? And what I learned from my researcher is that, you know, you start with kind of a list of all the names of colleagues you have, and then you sort of decide, okay, this person is a definite no, this person is a definite yes, and this sort of middle ground of fence sitters, we have to decide who talks to them, who has an existing relationship with them and not, and whatnot. And I tried to have those conversations with some of my colleagues, and it didn't work, because the sort of biggest response was, I don't feel like this is my role to sort of intentionally use a relationship that I have with that person to try and convince them to go to a meeting. And there was a lot of pushback in terms of us as colleagues being kind of on the same footing in terms of status, whereas what I try to argue in the book is that fundamentally the organizing relationship is a relationship of power that is predicated on the organizer knowing more than the community leaders that they organize. And the semantics here are important. Organizers organize leaders. Leaders lead community residents, they lead their base, but leaders do not lead the organizers. So you have this sort of one-directional, even if individual organizers can learn from leaders, you have that still this sort of vector that goes from one entity to the other. And I think this is this sort of raises a lot of questions in terms of what is the effect of multiplying sort of pretty molecular organizing relationships in terms of building unrest and protests. And at the same time in France, one of the key problems we have is how to broaden the audience of the movement. If you look at the student movement, for instance, trying to think in terms of not speaking to ourselves, but trying to reach out to, you know, the students who might not know about the reform, who might disagree with some of the tactics that are used, that is a real blind spot. In a lot of the conversations I heard in my university and I know are happening in other places. So it's like difficult to sort of separate some of the, I want to say, more professional aspect of the work here from the some of the techniques, and because some of the pushback also is this is a manager's role. This is someone trying to tell people what to do in the name of building the organization or in the name of building the movement, and feeling like you're legitimate enough to say that to people actually builds on a really long history that, you know, folks are very often not aware of.
I want to dig into something you said about the relationship between organizers and leaders. And I'm curious a little bit, because as you lay it out, there is a relationship of power that goes one way. Can you think of examples through your research that have flipped that at all? Like, what are the points where there's been a tension there?
So I haven't seen examples where it gets flipped in the sense that it's actually pretty difficult to get into that relationship, into how it works, because I want to argue it works kind of like sort of attorney-client privilege, so you can't observe it from the outside. Mm-hmm. So unless you do the work yourself, you can't, as a French sociologist, actually see those one-on-one conversations where organizers try to either create participation from someone who's been kind of looking at all of this, or someone who already is involved to say, okay, so can you get more involved? Can you next time facilitate the meeting or speak at a public event? And that is completely impossible to observe directly. Now, I know from the interviews I did how it goes, how it works, but also I know that the way my interviewees talk about it, they talk about it from a certain perspective, right? And it's been more difficult to get fully the perspective of the leaders because you have that sort of filter. So it has been less easy to get as much the perspective of community leaders is a wish I had. And then it also probably has been difficult to alter precisely for the reason that organizing relationships kind of exist outside of contentious moments and try to sort of fend those off at the same time. Hence the sort of difficult relationship with social movements that I did witness. So the time I was doing the research, Black Lives Matter, so in like 2015, 2016, 2017, really was the movement that the groups I was looking at were related to in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of want to dig a little bit deeper into that question, but I actually, you talk about some of the organizers that you interviewed and that you spoke with, and I think, something obviously that's happened recently in Chicago, the election of Brandon Johnson as the next mayor, is something that, frankly, a lot of those organizers specifically and the milieu in which they organize, there's a deep engagement with that election. Yeah. And so I kind of want to ask, from your view, how the organizing that you did your research around, in a simple way, I could ask how you see that as having impacted kind of electoral work more broadly, or more specifically, the most recent Chicago municipal election. Also knowing that you were here doing research during some really interesting times of interaction between social movement, between kind of quote-unquote professional organizers and electoral politics. I'm thinking of the Bayanita campaign and Kim Fox's first campaign for state's attorney. But how do you see that organizing impacting electoral work and vice versa?
So I think it has impacted electoral work and politics on two levels. The first is the number of people with an organizing background who were elected into office. Johnson is the obvious example. He worked as an organizer for the CTU for a number of years. But if you look at other people, you have now in city council 10 out of 50 other people who do have an organizing background, which is unprecedented in the history of Chicago politics, and I want to say unprecedented throughout the country. If you look at Chicago and its place in sort of local politics in the U.S., it is the only city where a former organizer who did, who was instrumental in the 2012 CTU strike happening, that's the only place where this person now holds the highest political office at the local level. And the fact that organizer positions have become sort of stepping stone to political office is also very interesting. So it does not necessarily mean that these people will have very progressive politics all the way through. And so two good examples of that are Obama, pretty obviously, worked as an organizer in the 1980s in Chicago, was definitely not on the progressive side of the political spectrum. And then sort of more local iteration of that would be Denise Solis, who was an organizer in the 1980s, and then, who was appointed by Richard Daley in 1996 to fill the seat of an alderman, who was convicted for corruption. And then, Solis had this pretty interesting end of career, as some of you might be familiar with. So at that level, in terms of who are elected representatives, you have these changes that are really interesting. And then at the sort of more the level of people's practices, I know that some of the folks who I interviewed were very active, doing door knocking for Johnson's campaign and previous campaigns in 2019. So either at the very sort of the most grassroots level, or were involved as campaign workers, field directors, even if the organizations they work for are by law prevented from directly engaging with the electoral process. And here, I think that the sort of Bayanita campaign is a good example of moments when you can have a convergence of organizations like BYP 100 or Asada's Daughters, who might not necessarily have the same relationship with professional organizing as other groups. But in terms of like focusing on a common campaign, you have these moments when it's possible that there is cooperation. What I'm arguing is that this cooperation is a little bumpy, right? It's not because everyone works for the same campaign that suddenly you have this professional amateur distinction that fully disappears. And it plays out in this sort of very mundane day-to-day work of how do you build turnout, for instance. If you say, we're going, like, each organization is committing, I don't know, like, X number of people to the next meeting or to the next rally, professional organizers will immediately have, you know, skills they learned in training and in the work, and that, so they'll think in terms of, okay, phone banking, direct relationships, which activists will not necessarily, they will not necessarily have those skills, or at least not have them in a sort of internalized way that professional organizers do. And then these, it doesn't mean that you always have, like, all the time hierarchy between the two, but in certain moments, those boundaries do sort of become more rigid, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I want to shift perspective a little bit and ask you, I know you talked about starting your research in Chicago in 2015. But you didn't talk about why you decided to come to Chicago, and not just Chicago, but what drew you to exploring, you know, the history of community organizing in America.
So first, I wanted to understand what happened to Maoists in the United States. So because I knew that the sort of older movement generation, you know, people who had been involved in the Freedom Summer, for instance, there had been a lot of research on that, and I wanted to know what happened to the kind of next generation. And my assumption was that some of them had become social workers, because that's what I knew from what happened in France, where you had a pretty sort of significant Maoist movement as well. And then my assumption was that, okay, so social worker, probably community organizer, is the same thing. I did not know what it meant. I knew that the label existed. I had seen it.
Is this because of Obama?
You knew? Probably, yeah. I think that it was, I was like, I tried to understand what it was, and the label just made no sense to me. So I thought, you know, I'm going to investigate that. And I couldn't find former Maoists who had become community organizers. So my thesis advisor said, okay, so why don't you, instead of trying to find folks from the past, focus on what community organizing is today. And pick one city, you go there, you do some field work, and then we'll see what happens. And I picked Chicago because at first I wanted to go to like Baltimore, Oakland, and Chicago, and then my advisor was like, you have 3 weeks in town. Just pick one city. It's not like, it's not possible. And then I knew about Linsky, so I thought, you know, it makes sense given that Saul Linsky started his career here. So it makes sense, it was kind of pretty central in the country. And I think, so gradually, I came to understand that I did not understand what community organizing was because the label is so fickle, it's so difficult to define. Community means basically nothing in the U.S. Organizing is so vague that, like, the two combined, it could be basically anything, because, you know, the label is so positive, right? Who is against community and who is for something that is disorganized? So that helped me, my initial, like, total lack of understanding, I think has to do with that really ambivalent nature, the fact that the label is difficult to define. And interestingly enough, I think I did not find former Maoists, or sort of in a very residual way, who did become organizers, because the way the role was built historically is if your politics were too ideological, you couldn't do the work. You couldn't sort of stick with door knocking with folks who might have like zero politics, or just like, or maybe being forced by the organization into supporting a campaign that you did not want to work on. So if like the more political folks would not turn to that work just because it doesn't align with what they might think of their politics and how to express it. Because the other important aspect of organizing work is that, and that's where it's interesting from a non-American perspective, is that staffers are not the ones who speak for the organization. And from a sort of critical sociology perspective in France, you have this assumption that staffers are the ones who speak for the organization. Staffers are spokespeople. And here you have a real dissociation between who creates the conditions for collective speaking, for representation, for speaking on behalf of a group, and then who does the actual speaking. And here you have a very clear divide between organizer and leader that is taken, you know, sort of, that seems obvious to a lot of movement folks, but that is, has a history, and that is the history that I write about.
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, Reform, Revolution, and Opportunism, Debates in the Second International, 1900 to 1910, edited by Mike Tabor. At its height, from 1889 to 1914, the Second Socialist International represented the majority of organized workers in the world, with the revolutionary goal of overthrowing capitalism. Its major accomplishments, such as the 8-hour day and International Women's Day, testify to its lasting influence around the world. In this important collection of debates at Congresses of the Second International, Reform, Revolution, and Opportunism captures the International's vibrancy and gives a snapshot of its strengths, weaknesses, and contradictions. As David McNally puts it, this book is a treasure chest for every socialist seeking to understand the history of their movement. Bringing together documents from 1900 to 1910, Mike Tabor shows us how socialists more than a century ago analyzed and debated key questions of their time. Find Reform, Revolution, and Opportunism at haymarketbooks.org.
I want to think a little bit about how you, so you've talked, obviously there's a lot in the book about professionalization of organizing. There's kind of, you know, when that term happened. You've talked a bit about, you know, we kind of talked a little bit about leaders versus organizers. And you've talked about politics as something, I think in some ways like separate from the organizing, or maybe a different sphere. I'm a little bit curious how you think about the impact on internal political dynamics inside an organization and how the professionalization of organizing has changed that, and if you also see any other kind of evolution or development in how internal politics works. I would also add that a part of what's in my head, and this isn't directly in relationship to the book, is really about some of the new developments in the labor movement. The you know, new leadership in the United Auto Workers, in the Teamsters as they gear up to fight UPS. A lot of independent unions forming around the country in high-profile ways that are kind of like staying out of that. And I know your book is about community organizing, but there's obviously relationship between community and union organizing as well.
So again, that's a pretty tough...
Yeah.
That's a really tough one. So historically, the role was built as organizers' politics have to kind of stay personal politics for a long time. If you sort of look at the Ilinsky, all the organizations that Ilinsky built in his like 30 plus years of career was like, you can't bring your politics to how you try to organize leaders and organizations, because they're trying just to build like kind of the broadest denominator in a given neighborhood so that you can bring basically anyone on board, right? Including like business associations, just like groups that potentially have very different politics than your own. And I think that the interesting aspect here is that this somewhat changed in the 1980s and 90s as the professional group gained coherence and as people could make a living out of organizing and could, you know, have careers as organizers, and you would have sort of two competing visions of what the work would be like. So one aspect which sort of is pretty much in keeping with that creme brulee management consulting. Thing is, you stick to being non-political. You stick to being non-ideological. And the work is not about ideology. The work is about building citizen representation, and then people will decide for themselves, as the phrasing went at the time. And then you would have this other pole in the ecosystem where it is important that organizers do have politics. It is important that organizers talk about race, talk about gender, and that if a neighborhood you are trying to organize, you know, wants to keep African American people out of the neighborhood when it's not, even if it's what the people mean, then your politics just are so not in line with this that it's that you're not going to do this, and you should try to build, to bring a sort of racial lens to that issue. So that tension, I think, that is the moment when this tension comes together. And then given also the political context, certain aspects of the work will be, you know, to push to the fore more. And I want to argue that the post-2008, so Great Recession, wave of protest that has, developed throughout the 2010s, really pushed to the fore the idea that the organizer's position should not just be to sort of be a technician of building an organization, but that you have to have politics. And here Chicago is a really interesting example. Because you had those, I want to say like almost 20 years of relationships developing between unions to speak to that. Certain labor unions, the CTU, SEIU, healthcare, which developed like really close relationships with certain community organizations, and it helped to broaden the perspective of, you know, what is it that they're trying to do collectively. And what we're trying to do collectively is go beyond politics as usual. And because, you know, Rahm Emanuel was such a great, anyway, he's like a sort of harbinger of Macron, right? So very arrogant, very obnoxious, and very good at antagonizing, right? And I think that this is something that we talked about recently with a couple of folks that I interviewed for the research, is that the sort of some of the defeats that the movement in Chicago experienced, like the 50 schools closing, the mental health clinics closing, helped really to focus the attention on Rahm and helped to build a common denominator, which, you know, led to the United Working Families coming together, and then having this kind of broad tent that was not just a temporary coalition, but you had like lasting relationships that were built between community organizers and union organizers, and then between organizations more broadly. So that I think has like no real equivalent in other cities.
Mm-hmm. I bet Rahm would like that Macron. maybe we can get him to watch the recording of this last year. And I think there is, I just want to kind of state something, like as you were talking, like I was thinking about labor organizing, and it's, which is, even when you say those words, union organizing, there's an antagonistic element to that is baked in. Community organizing can mean anything you want it to mean. Yeah. And so I want to take that as like a little bit of an opportunity to dig into one of the ways that you frame some of the central questions in the book. You kind of go into, I think it was the living room of an Alinsky-trained organizer, a one-time organizer, and you make the comparison. He's got out a stack of Saul Alinsky's books and then a stack of kind of management literature, and that you see a parallel here. I want to dig a little bit more deeply into that. You use that, you kind of keep coming back to that comparison as you think about kind of an Alinskyism or Alinsky school of organizing. I would also just say, as somebody who comes out of SEIU organizing, I've read Good to Great. I've read a lot of this management literature. I think a lot of organizers have, who've been trained in certain different elements. I'm curious about how you see the impact kind of on the ground as it relates to organization development,
And where do you see that kind of parallel going now and in the future?
Another.
I'm not making this easy.
It's good, but it's also.
It's coming up from the conversation a little bit, you know.
So that was another moment, the moment I was in Patrick's living room, and I couldn't understand why. So at some point, he points to Good to Great, or another Harvard Business School management book, and he says, Ilinsky could have written this. And as an organizer, to me, this is Ilinsky, kind of playbook. And for a while, completely puzzling, right? Because I thought Ilinsky, built people power, was on the side of democracy. Why is all of this literature making so much sense to this guy? And I never read anything about that. And what I think it points to is what I was kind of alluding to earlier, the fact that in the organizing work itself, you have, the goal is, to build a stronger organization, to develop the organization using the existing resources that you have. And that, in the context of community-based organizations, that means expanding the number of people who are part of the organization, or at least who you can reach out to when you want to sort of display the power that you as an organization say that you have. And that is also one of the reasons why it's difficult, I think, to import organizing practices in France, because the sort of left-wing milieus in France have a sort of very epidermic relation to first a lot of stuff that comes from the U.S., to be honest. There's some strong anti-Americanism that is still out there in many circles, and then the fact that there is a management component, being in a position where you tell others what to do and what not to do, even if this means telling people that the only solution is that they come together and they organize, they sort of come together and sort of organize protests. There still is this element of telling others what mm-hmm. to do, and so that's from the sort of perspective of the work. And the other interesting connection that I saw with management consulting is that in terms of people's careers. This is where I think it's interesting not just to look at the work and the organizations, but also at the people themselves. Mm-hmm. Where do organizers come from, and what they do after working as organizers? And what I found in the work is that becoming management consultants is one of the possible existing careers after organizing. Another one would be philanthropy, academia, although my feeling is that today, given how difficult it is to enter academia, we have few organizers who transition to that. Labor unions is another important site where former organizers can keep doing the work. And then politics would be another one. And then, of course, you have outliers, like people becoming yoga teachers, for instance. That happens as well. But those are kind of the main places where you go, not necessarily because you chose to. That's something I insist mm-hmm. on in the book. A lot of what I talk about is constraints is like the playing field. And it's not necessarily a decision you make. You say, I want to do radical spade work, and you're hell with management consulting. Well, because the work has developed this way historically, it's not a choice that you make the way you would choose between different cookies at a shop or whatever. Same with the careers. You don't know it when you start working as an organizer that the possible futures, professional futures for you, are actually fairly limited from the mm-hmm. sort of sociological perspective. Of course, as an individual, you can say, I want to do something completely different. But because of the work you do, it sort of shapes how you envision yourself, your sort of role in society, and what would be rewarding for you as well.
Yeah, I'm not thinking of had I been faced with those choices like 20-some years ago. But I was also thinking, you also made me think, like earlier we were talking about the 10 members of the Chicago City Council who are professional organizers, and I wonder if that's a safety valve if you realize you won't get tenure as an academic if you decide you're going to run for City Council. We can dig into that later on, maybe over beer. I did want to, I have a couple of questions that go in different directions. But they're both about kind of parallels between your own experience in France and kind of what has been interesting to you or instructive. So I'm gonna let you choose one of these paths to go down. One of them is thinking about kind of American expressions of organizing into a global perspective. I know there have been attempts to kind of export the ACORN model of organizing to Paris and France more broadly, to other places around the world. I know that the Industrial Areas Foundation has also done that. I'm sure there are other organizations and networks that have done the same. Those are the two where I've talked to people in Paris about their experiences there, so that's one. The other is really before professionalization, before the kind of, you know, the 70s and 80s moments of professionalization. Do you think there were more parallels globally with how organizing happened in the United States? It's not a very well-formed question, but really thinking about, was there a divergence that is greater now than it was at some point in history? And, you know, if so, you know, is there something we can learn or think about from that? So you have your choice of questions there.
So I think I'll take question two, but maybe I'll try to include stuff from question one. Okay.
You can go off on another. You can go off on something else altogether.
I do think that until the 70s, there were more parallels based on the fact that there was, in terms of how commitments worked, you could look at the level of individuals, at the level of organizations, and then the ties between organizations. After the 70s and 80s, there is an extra layer that gets added in the US context, which is the occupation layer, where, you know, you think in terms of training manuals being published, in terms of trainings existing. You have this entire body of literature and institutions that have really no equivalent, that have, like, for decades been no equivalent in France, for instance. And there's a lot of literature, you can think of, like, The Forge or Convergence magazine, where you have pieces that do talk about the sort of nitty-gritty work of what is organizing, how do you build a base, and then discussions over that. That does not exist in the French literature that I know. And if it does, it is stuff that pitches itself as sort of breaking with the old ways of, you know, being a militant, and that very often do rely on this sort of non-profit model that looks to, you know, like digital technologies, so-called civic tech kind of stuff. And that, I think, is a place where it has become maybe more difficult to sort of build connections internationally. Because if you see yourself as an organizer, you've had, you know, like those years of internalizing that identity and all the practices that it entails, you speak to, like, folks at my university, folks, you know, in other labor unions, at some point there's a level of misunderstanding. Because you don't, like, the words that you use, the base, for instance, you cannot translate that into anything that you could sort of activate in the French context. And conversely, talking about how to be intentional about growing the organization, there's a lot of pushback here. There are sort of places where, you know, certain labor unions, for instance, have tried to be more intentional about, you know, how to unionize other not necessarily unionize other places, but how to grow the organization in a more intentional way and not just waiting for people to show up, which is kind of the sort of default position.
That's the French model.
Yeah, so French organizing culture would be people show up on their own terms, and it's none of your business to try and convince them with other things that ideas and arguments. So you can write a leaflet saying, the pension reform plan is bullshit for X, Y, and Z. But not being, okay, so being intentional about and kind of cynical about, you know, how to use existing relationships to bring people in without being sort of forthright about the reason why are you bringing them in. And but that so I think that the difficulty is where to keep some of the techniques that have developed here without sort of separating that from the entire what's the word for that? I don't know, but like the fact, for instance, that you cannot develop proper organizer positions in France because you don't have anything like a philanthropic field that could fund all of these positions. So what you have instead is people, you know, working as interns or like volunteers who are even more burned out than what they would be in the U.S. Because one of the perks of having this occupation existing is that you can actually, you know, you will have long hours, the pay will not be great, but you can still live both for it and off it, which is not the case in France at the moment.
Mm-hmm. So I have one more question that I'm going to ask, and then I want to see if there are questions from the audience. And that is in thinking about the scope of, so you started your research in 2015. We're sitting here 8 years later. The world has changed dramatically, I think, in a few different ways. And we were talking earlier a little bit about kind of professional organizers' relationships with, like, the Occupy Wall Street movement. Yeah. We were talking before the event. I'm curious about your perspective from your research and from your experience of whether those relationships have shifted and how, if we think about Occupy Wall Street through the explosion of the movement for Black Lives into the uprising of 2020 and the pandemic moment. How has that relationship changed and shifted?
So I think it might be too early to say, but my assumption is that some of the folks who were involved in the 2020 uprising will, if they want to, you know, keep being involved, one of the possibilities is, you know, you become an organizer somewhere. So that, because the sort of existing institutional nexus is not enough to sustain those commitments, to retain those commitments, to use a pretty useful sociological category. And then what will be interesting to see in the next couple of years and how those movement experiences will shape people's relation to the work. Mm-hmm. When, for instance, you know, another BLM moment happens, how will the people who have, you know, come to the work as a result of this this politicization, how will they relate to it individually, and how will they manage to have the discussions within the organization that they work for to sort of push the organization's activity towards participating to that? And the sort of probably, again, it will have a lot of friction with whatever organization at that time in the future, is more sort of movement committed and movement oriented. But what is interesting is that the generation that I spoke to when I did my research, some of them had been politicized by Occupy Wall Street. Some of them had been politicized by kind of the sort of post 2008 moment. And they had pretty different politics from the older folks that I met, just in terms of what they did outside of work. So like the younger, the people who were kind of my age at the time, who also could relate to much more easily, they would campaign for, they would canvass for Carlos
Ramirez Rosa
in the 35th Ward. They would canvass for, you know, other progressive, other people. In 2019, they would canvass for Jeanette Taylor. So they, if you look beyond just the work and, you know, the friends they have, if you look at these people from a sort of whole worker perspective, in a way, all the social spheres that they are involved in, they were much more attuned to movement politics than the older folks were. You know, in part because the older folks, when they got their position and then moved up the hierarchies, you had like no equivalent, no such like broad movement that could sort of lift them up and push them to more, the more political aspect of their daily lives.
All right. Well, that actually brought, I have like an hour more worth of questions based on that answer. But I want to take a minute and see if we have some questions from the audience here. And I'm right over here. Yes.
Well, again, thanks so much for your work and coming to share it with us here in Chicago. I have a question about when you talk about the Alinsky strain in terms of kind of corporate consulting organizing and then what you refer to as state organizing. And did you see any difference along the lines of race? And this is what I mean by that. So a lot of times in the corporate organizing, what you mentioned, a lot of the people who are doing the organizing assume that they know more than the folks on the ground doing the work. But if you look at folks like Ella Baker, and I'm thinking about Marion Stamps here in Chicago some years back, it was the understanding that they could do nothing without people because they had the same understandings as them and came from them. So did you see any difference along the lines of race in those two types, those two strands of organizing?
Let's
go with that.
Fantastic question. Thank you for asking it, because it is one of the ways in which that tension has really manifested itself. In part because how the work was conceived of in the Alinsky tradition. The work was, you know, you have, like, the sort of standard is an organizer has to come from the outside so that he, and I'm using he because, you know, Alinsky sort of was very explicit that he did not want to hire women for a long time because, you know, women would be bad organizers from his perspective. And then the very few women he hired, you know, he gave them a really hard time, and I don't think they would stay very long. So Alinsky's idea was a white man has to come from the outside, figure out the lay of the ground, so lay of the land, bring everyone on board, and then leave after a couple of years. And that, of course, did not correspond with Baker's work and the sort of entire, you know, the fact that, as you point out, the question of race was brought to the fore by, you know, movements in the 60s and 70s, and then the folks that came out of that politicization clearly would not say, well, you know, that does not really matter. What we need is just having anyone who's an expert organizing something and then leaving. And then what comes out of that moment, 60s and 70s, is the idea that if you want to be involved in the collective action by the oppressed, you have to come from the group, whether it is because you're African-American or Latinx, or whether you, if you're a woman, which that sort of, gender part of the equation was less present in the discussions in the 80s and 90s, but people like Gary Delgado, who comes out of the welfare rights movement in the late 60s, who was one of the founders of ACORN, would regularly say, well, we have to take race into account, both in the campaigns that we run, but also in who is the organizer, because that has an effect on how we do the work. So you have those sort of two competing definitions of who the organizer should be. And the other interesting thing here is that the moment when the group, the profession merges, so 70s, 80s, that moment, is also the moment when you start having more organizers of color and more women. So kind of, which is another interesting conclusion, right? It's the moment when it really turns into something that people can make a living of, that you have a diversification of who the organizers are. It's no longer white men. However, the constant, the really sort of historical constant here is college education. Regardless of, you might have like more racial diversity, you might have more women and probably non-binary folks doing the work, you still have that important social divide that sort of stays built into the work. But that really is, and at the same time, it doesn't mean that, people of color will not work in the Wunsky tradition, right? It just means that the way that their identity can be activated into the work will be looked at pretty differently.
Any other questions? That was really good. Thank you for that. Let me go right here to the front and then gentlemen.
Right. Thank you. I'm wondering, I haven't read your book, but just on what you've said, if you could comment on this, something I know from my background. My stepfather was a founder with William Casey of the Manhattan Institute, which is kind of a CIA front that I know relied on, they kind of took the Alinsky method and put it together with Ayn Rand's theories. Have you seen this pattern, this professional, like capitalism kind of infiltrated and started using these methods? What effect has that had, in terms of this professionalization? And also, I guess kind of related to it is my own experience. I was working with the Alliance Against Racist Political Oppression, and I started actually with Obama's Organizing for Action, looking for gun violence coalition building. And so I just bumped into them, and they seemed to be such good organizers. But it's so difficult to bring together the white privileged class with the oppressed people, political color, repression, that kind of thing. Maybe looking at anti-war, too. I don't see any anti-war movement, which I would think would cover both.
Yeah, that's a lot of big questions.
Yes.
The Manhattan Institute.
That's right.
That is quite
counter-revolutionary.
Has been very relevant still to this day. Yeah.
So what I want to say, going a little deeper into Alinsky's career, is what you see, developing in the 1960s, is Alinsky pitching himself as a professional slum organizer, the media buying into it and sort of glorifying him over a certain movement, people, for instance, and him turning to, in terms of who he worked with, sort of broadening the spectrum of who his clients were. Until the 60s, Alinsky's clients were mostly kind of local neighborhood groups, very often faith, very often ministers reaching out to him to organize something. Mm-hmm. And then in the 60s, you have large corporations reaching out to Alinsky, sort of second half of the 1960s, asking for his take on power and organization in general. For instance, there's this moment in the book when I talk about how he was approached by AT&T, and there's this guy, another consultant, who's like, okay, so we want your, what you think, your philosophy of humankind and what you think about power and what you think about, and then Nalinsky goes, right? And he speaks to like this guy, John Sheridan, for instance, who ended up being one of the very important figures in building the union busting consulting industry in the 1970s. And Sheridan saying that he learned a lot of his techniques from Nalinsky. Because, again, it boils down to how do you build an organization and what's the position you can have from the outside in terms of, you know, what organizational development is and what it's not. And the thing is, when you start defining this work and you say, you know, it's independent from politics, it's something in itself. Like, you have sort of good technicians who know how to build an organization from scratch and keep it running and make sure that you build engagement, which is what managers do as well, right? How do you make workers more productive? Well, how do you make community leaders more invested in the organization? How do you sort of not just retain their commitment, but increase it, increase the sort of democratic productivity of a given organization? And that is, you know, was sort of very present in Nalinsky's work in the late 60s. Unfortunately, he died quite suddenly in 1972, so it's unclear what he would have done later on. It's unclear whether that aspect of him, you know, being the sort of professional organizer of the rich, what the balance would have been between, you know, like reaching out to like black ministers in Rochester, New York, or AT&T and other companies like that. And that's where I think that you have the connection with management consulting. And the reason why you have folks like Patrick, who I interviewed, that's sort of two pilot books, who saw what, so he worked as a sort of organizational development guy in the 1980s, and he saw it as a direct continuation of his work with the IAF. And you have the same stuff today with, you know, people ending up working as like diversity managers, for instance, because you keep the idea of, okay, but I'm doing this for like the good of the organization. I'm doing this, and sometimes it's true, right? I'm not sort of casting blame on, okay, so like this is not what people should be doing, but seeing the continuity between working as an organizer and doing that work, like abstract the politics. Mm-hmm.
Let me go back here, and then who else has questions? Let me see. Can I get a show of hands? Okay, let me go to the gentleman right here.
Thank you. As you mentioned, Clement, you know, and you're aware of this. There's a long-standing sort of both academic and sort of social critique of Alinskyism. And we see it in sort of Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward's work, and we've seen it Robert Fisher, the historian, and we see it in, actually more recently in Lincoln Sen and other sort of folks who've made the argument that in some sense I think you're making, which is that this kind of pragmatic orientation of Alinskyism is not just a kind of a particular kind of liberal centrist political sensibility that informs the work, and it's not simply because of the kind of professionalization of the role, but it's also, as you were, I think, just suggesting in your last comment, it's baked into organization building itself. That to build an organization makes you inherently conservative, and it means when there are moments of movement upsurge, you find yourself kind of clinging to your organization rather than mobilizing members who might be participating and amplify kind of the impacts of a movement. And I was really heartened to hear you, and I think Alex suggested this as well, that it's possible that we may be here at a sea change with younger organizers who have become more politicized because of the events of the last 15 years, kind of moving into sort of organization leading kinds of positions. I'm wondering, you know, and I think what you were saying is that sort of it's still open, you know, the extent to which this change is really happening. I guess my feeling is we should begin to see it happening, not only in the activities within organizations, if it is going to happen, but also in their trainings. Kind of, I mean, this sort of such a part of this industry that you described has been the creation of training institutes that codify certain kinds of trainings and that reproduce a certain kind of pragmatic approach to organizing. I'm wondering if you have a sense of whether that is changing at all, or whether you would expect to see it change kind of in the next 10 years or so. And, you know, why, what might drive organizations that might be inherently conservative to kind of open up and deepen the kind of political components of their training?
That is the tough one. And it's tough because I haven't been here, as I said, for like the past 5 years, so it's really hard, like beyond the sort of, you know, headlines and everything, but to understand how the work has changed or not is something that I've tried to do ever since I landed like 9 days ago. And my sense is that is so in terms of the politics, I think that a lot of the post-COVID moment has seeped into organizing conversations. And the fact that Johnson was elected also sort of opens up a lot of opportunities to rethink, you know, what organizations are going to do in terms of holding him accountable, and then maybe, you know, like just in terms of pushing certain policies like the treatment, not trauma ordinance, for instance. But I am curious to see how the training piece changes. I know that back in 2016, I attended a training at the Midwest Academy, and there was like huge pushback on the part of trainees because the curriculum was just so silent on questions of race. And like, when I say pushback, I mean at some point trainees say, you know, we are going to reorganize the room, we are going to like change the schedule and talk about talk about race, talk about Black Lives Matter. And I know that this type of sort of revolt from the trainees happened another time and pushed Midwest Academy to change its curriculum to a certain extent. I don't know, however, how much has changed after that moment and how much has changed since. And I'd be super curious to see how that has sort of gone through all the filters, like organizational filters, professional filters, because at the end of the day, you still have that idea that there are some techniques you need to learn. You need to like hold an organizing conversation where you have like 5 or 6 parts, right? So you have like, so you break eyes, and then you have some chit chat, and then you sort of get to the big ask that you're supposed to do, then you follow up, all of that. And that cannot completely disappear. But yeah, I would love to know how that has you know, translated, adding more more politics to the discussion. So like, yeah, hopefully I'll get to see that in the future.
We'll go to Jason and then Inna. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for the book. So I appreciate the like being critical of Alinsky. I think that part's important, the philanthropy part, the managerial part, and then talking about like the state work approach to organizing. I guess my question is, and it even came up like when you said that, you know, the biggest difference is usually folks are college educated in terms of organizers. And I'm like, how much do you feel like your book that is like, I guess like partially biased versus like the people that you're talking to? Because like my experience is that in fact, a lot of organizers aren't college educated, or a lot of organizers are actually formerly incarcerated, that usually it's one of the few places where you could actually get a job. It's comparable to the trades in the fact that it's literally just, it's less of a profession in terms of white collar professional managerial, but it's far more of what you would consider a trade. And for sure the salaries are comparable to what people would get in trades, but I guess when you, and I haven't finished reading the book yet, so maybe you do mention this or whatever, but within the spade work aspect of it, in the spade work sections, it's still less focused on this idea that organizing is a craft. And then how much of that would you say is connected to, you did this thing when you periodized, like putting the 60s putting the like the 60s as a moment of professionalization, and not, why not, or at least like conversating with like what somebody like McLevy did, which was saying that actually you get closer to some semblance of a professionalization of an organizer within the party for sure, right? Not within like a philanthropic context, but with folks like Foster, with folks like Musty, with folks like Rustin, that these were people who were working professionally as organizers, whether it was within a party, whether it was within a union, whether it was within whatever, you know, Fellowship of Reconciliation, things like that. That and it comes from the syndicalist communist tradition, like that, that the spade work wasn't just like this addiction to structure-based organizing just to be proper about it and like anti-Alinsky, but that it has real, you know, it has a real radical basis and like within working class organizing as like the larger thing. So I was just wondering, what was that decision around periodizing spade work in that way as anti-Alinsky in terms of and not maybe going further back?
Wow, another pretty tough question, but it's great. So the sort of college-educated piece, so I'm not saying that all organizers are college-educated. I'm just saying that the majority of them are. It's difficult to get a sense of like the sort of statistics here, because just the profession, the sort of work itself has been so difficult to define. One of the attempts that I know of was by this professional organization, the National Organizers Alliance. So it was founded, you know, in 1994, and its goal was to defend organizing as a craft. And, you know, it sort of specifically talked to funders saying, if you want to bring about social change, you have to invest in us. You have to invest in us because we are social innovators and that we know how to create the sort of organized change that you're looking at. And they tried to, one of the stuff that they attempted to do was to have a survey of who the organizers were. And the archives that I studied were, you know, sort of, for a lot of reasons, terribly unkempt, and it was difficult to go through them, and I didn't find the results of that survey. So I don't exactly know what it came out of. But, so it's hard to say, you know, in terms of whether before it was entirely just college-educated folks, but it certainly is true that when I say that the recruitment has diversified and democratized, you have former community leaders who do become organizers now. For a long time, the norm was a leader cannot be an organizer because it's different roles. Sort of everyone, you know, stays to their area of expertise, and you can't transfer to one. You would have lots of stories of this person was a community leader, became an organizer, was a terrible organizer. So that shows that this sort of distinction holds. And the other thing to sort of build up on what you said is saying that it is an occupation does not mean that it has become a trait, right? It doesn't mean that it has become this sort of very respectable work that only, you know, college-educated folks would do. And when you look at the college-educated folks who do the work, often it's sort of like, it's either, what's the word, like downclassing, so like people with sort of a downwardly mobile trajectory, or people who are upwardly mobile, you know, who's very often they're like the first in their family to go to college, and then working as an organizer is kind of a way to give back to the community is the phrase that I would hear often. And then you have different sorts of colleges, right? It's like folks sometimes graduate with an associate degree, or so it's not necessarily like people coming out of Harvard and Yale becoming organizers. And then possibly, I don't know, but maybe there has been a change recently as well that I did not see when I did the field work. So maybe the work has, the sort of recruitment pool, maybe it has broadened even more. And that's possible, and that's something that I would be very interested in seeing. Now, the other part of your question, I'm not saying like you did have people in the various movements of the 60s who did the work full time, right? And who were committed to it, because at some point, like, you can't work a job and then do all the tasks that are sort of necessitated by a political organization, because you just have like 24 hours in a day, you know, you need sleeping, you need eating. You can't just be like full-time committed without at some point making the decision of, am I going to have a job and then do this in my spare time, or is this going to be a food? But the difference, I would say, with the Alinsky organizers is that the horizon was not to build the profession. The horizon is not at this point, you know, we need the expertise to be recognized by Marshall Field in the Catholic Church. And, you know, like, Alinsky is very, like, sort of forthright in certain annual reports in the AIF. He says, okay, so we have to write more material that shows that the expertise is real. He says it's an art, it's not something you can necessarily teach. He never talked about methods. They would talk more about procedures. Also, coincidentally, Alinsky never used the phrase community organizing. He would talk about community organization, which is something different. Talk about mass organization, he would talk about lots of different stuff, but the phrase that has been so associated with him, when you look at the archives, the association just does not exist. And in terms of the periodizing spade work, I'm not sure I... So I started with Baker because she's the one who uses the phrase.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it made sense in terms... It doesn't mean that before you did not have that type of approach to organizing work existing, but she is... I want to say she's the kind of origin of using a lot of pedagogical stuff and applying it to collective action. And also, that's where also you have interesting lineages, right? Alinsky comes out of social work, criminology, and an onus of outside management stuff. Baker comes out of teaching radical pedagogy, where you do define the role of the teacher in terms of they learning probably as much from the students as the other way around. Yeah, right. But at the same time, You do have a relation with power there as well, right? It's not just that one would be super hierarchical and vertical and the other would be, you know, like, wonderfully horizontal. Because you do have, like, in like, sort of, the sort of teachers who, you know, have this sort of anti-pedagogy stance still are teachers at the end of the day, right? And you still have that imbalance, which sometimes changes, but... still, you know, relies on a sort of difference in terms of cultural capital among other things. I don't know if that answered your question, but it's it got me thinking.
I just had this picture in my head of William Z. Foster writing a report to Marshall Field and the Catholic Campaign for Human Development.
But let me move on, and I think Inhe had a question over here.
Yeah, so I want to jump off.
You can buy it in the back.
Yes,
oh,
I
wish
I came earlier, so I missed a lot of it. Just if you, you know, already addressed it from you, then I will catch up. But, you know, just in terms of Alinsky's style, as we know, you know, just, yeah, like, really void of that race, gender, you know, those kind of issues. You know, and also, like, so much practicality, often geographically bound or workplace bound, and, like, clear, you know, issue that you are campaigning against, and all of that. So, you know, in a way, like, I work with, you know, the immigrant justice organization with our Korean-American multi-ethnic immigrants, and so we, Alinsky doesn't come up, so it's really kind of interesting to be here to talk and even to critique about Alinsky, because he really hasn't been part of the conversation even, you know, and I think many people would say when he read, what is it, one of his books, I remember closing it, you know, going, what a fucking asshole. Practicalities, but seriously, I was like, wow, right? vision is awesome, and you know, like led by the students at Al Baker and like movements of movement from Black Lives, and we're learning so much. But I guess the other question I had was in your, I mean, you just said that you haven't been here for a while, so maybe, you know, maybe you haven't seen, but just wanted to know through your research and study as a, you know, the researcher of this field, if you had incorporated or seen immigrant rights, immigrant justice organizing, and how, you know, because that this group is really, there's like identity issue, there's a language issue, and it's one where I would like to say, like in any others, it's really intersectional. You have to look at all those, right? Race, gender, class, immigration status. There's so many ways that people can participate or not, and also many bring experiences and history of different movements from other parts of the world that are in some ways, you know, really refreshing and different. Like today I was just reading about, as many of you here, about the landless workers movement in Brazil. It's like, oh my God, that was so inspiring, right? And you being in France. So just wanted to make a comment on how you might have seen that connection or some changes in that of immigrants.
Not very tough.
Yeah, we're not, no softballs.
Yeah, right. So in terms of Alinsky, what I want to say is, it's, like, his legacy goes beyond, like, sort of institutionalized legacy goes beyond the stuff he wrote. And my argument is that even in the most, in the organizing that seems, in the professional organizing that seems the most averse to Alinsky, you know, to Alinsky's politics, to anything that has to do with Alinsky, you still have that component, for instance, of it's a craft. You know, it's something, it's like, it's a craft, so it's something you have to learn through separate institutions that are either like retreats or like training seminars, or it is something that exists sort of autonomously from other areas of practice. And the other thing is that leader-organizer distinction. The idea, for instance, that you have organic, natural leaders, you can definitely tie back to Alinsky, even if, you know, the people who might use those distinctions will say that they are very anti-Alinsky or that they have nothing to do with Alinsky. But that sort of shaping of the role really goes back to how he, through his like 30 plus years of like career as a political entrepreneur, how he developed the work and how the institutions and the books that he wrote were either taken up by other folks in the 70s and 80s, and maybe the Alinsky label disappeared, but you still have that element that is part of the, that's why I say that the sort of spectrum between Spade work and Krangerlee is like, the two are always connected. The connection varies from one person to the next, it varies from one organization to the next, it varies from one city to the next, also depending on history of the local politics, but you still have that tension that is part of the work. And then, I really like your argument, so the idea that when you look, for instance, at immigrant justice organizing, you have different questions and different issues that probably like bring the Spade work more, right? That bring the question of what is the prior experience of the people we work with and how do we incorporate that into the work. And in certain questions, maybe, you know, I haven't, to be honest, I haven't thought of that, about how different issues alter the work in different ways. So that is something that that's sort of to go back to the previous question of, you know, am I partial in what I write? I think that there is an element of when you focus, you focus on certain aspects, and it's difficult to incorporate everything else, right? And at certain points, like, how does it all fit together? So maybe the next step is for me to reintegrate that, some of those issues, to see whether housing organizing, like, what are the differences with immigrant justice organizing? What are the differences with climate justice organizing? So yeah, I can only like give that as an answer, but yeah, that's a really good point.
Are there any other questions from the audience? Julie?
When you were talking about France, it struck me that one difference there is the just the union membership density is so much greater in France than the U.S. And I'm just wondering whether you think that the fact that they don't have that concept of a union or about community organizing in the U.S. and sort of occupy that space, that we don't have as many people in unions here, and so we needed some way to organize working class people. And, you know, union organizers, I assume, occupy some slightly different role for you, or different positionality. You know, they are still full-time and professional, but maybe they're livelihoods depend on membership dues and not foundations, or you know, are more accountable to the membership potentially, but still it does feel like we have a hole here in this country in terms of people who can do political organizing and their community organizations sort of take up some of that role here. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Okay. Yeah. Really. No softballs.
we'll make that the last one. then people can grab you with their own individual picks.
So I'm not sure that union density is larger in France than it is in the U.S. In part because of the way that unions operate in France. We don't have sort of closed shop. Background. So in a given workplace, you will have like 7 different unions vying for union leadership. Also because joining a union is entirely voluntary. Like, you join a workplace, there's a collective contract that holds regardless of your union affiliation. Which also means that unions are kind of potentially more political. Or at least, even if they don't, so there is a pretty rigid distinction between the union sphere and the political sphere. Even something like the CGT, for instance, which had historically very strong ties with the Communist Party, would still not sort of explicitly say, you know, we are communist affiliated. So in terms of numbers, I'm not entirely sure.
I think it's actually roughly equivalent,
okay,
membership-wise, although many more workers in France are covered by collective agreements, and some of those standards are bargained at the national level.
Yeah. And then the history of labor unions in France are also, like, the CGT comes out of anarcho-syndicalism, right? So you have that, the sort of closeness with Western politics is much, much more. Like, we never had a Samuel Gompers, right? We never had someone who said, you know, labor is about just bread and butter issues and we'll keep the communists out, which is also what Alinsky did. Like, his politics were so anti-communist. He, you know, like, that's a tangent, but I want to share it with you. He was invited by the Pope, by someone who would become the Pope in Rome in, like, 60 or 61, to share with that guy what his techniques would do in terms of the Italians fending off the communists. And it's, you know, it's like written, like you have like letters from Montini saying, like, we'd be very interested in learning how to, you know, sort of out-organize the communists. So in France, you have a history of labor organizing being more, like, less hostile to politics, less hostile to political organizing. However, I do think that you have a point when you say that the sort of the broader field is different, in part because, you know, like, although the French left is in shambles at the moment, you have this history of, you know, like, the sort of anti-communist repression in France was nowhere near what it was here. And that's also why I think it's interesting to look at community organizing in terms of that sort of mid-layer of the occupation itself. Because in France, you could have like unions and political organizations being the sort of vessel for movement activity, both at the individual level and at the level of ideas being sort of not appropriated by political organizations. The Socialist Party, for instance, in France, was a huge place where you would have all those radicals from the May 68 ending up, right? People who were active in like small left-wing organizations in like 1981 when Mitterrand was elected, sort of shifting, or kind of before that, shifting to, okay, you know, like we actually are going to root for this guy. And now you have like lots of pretty prominent left-wing politicians who do come out of those politics. Of course, you have no equivalent of that in the Democratic Party, apart from like a couple of outliers, but the left looked like something really different from like the political field in the US. And then unions were also places where people could go. And the last thing I want to say is, in terms of the institutional structure, community organizing here does, like, the community level does mean something, because you have this, you know, like federal government, right? You have the sort of locals. Like you can do a lot of stuff at the local level that you can't do in France. If you think about the school system in Chicago, for instance, you could have, you know, a very prominent union say, we oppose school privatization, because you had a system where the mayor ran the schools, or like the mayor appointed the person who ran the schools. In France, schools are a national thing. Teachers take national exams. They have no control over where they work. You take the exam, and then kind of the next couple of weeks, you know that, you know, you lived in Paris and you were going to work in Marseille, for instance. The curriculum is defined nationally. The wages are defined nationally. So what it means to be a teacher in France is like you have this sort of very sort of like, you know, you share working conditions with every single teacher in the country. Here it's not the case, right? You're a teacher in Chicago or a teacher in Kentucky. You don't teach the same stuff. You don't make the same wages. Like you belong to the same group, but in a sort of very kind of very abstract way, right? And in terms of the unions as well, you don't have sort of coherence in terms of individual states. So that's also where you have the possibility for something that is very that is grounded in a very local understanding of politics being possible, I think.
All right, great. Well, I think we can close out our questions now. We had enough challenging questions from all.
They were great. Thank you all.
I want to thank Haymarket Books and Haymarket House for having us here, for putting this great book out. If you haven't bought it yet, if you're in the room, it's back there at the table. If you're watching the live stream, it's available at haymarketbooks.com. And you can find some really good coverage of movements at inthesetimes.com. Where I work. I want to give Clément just a minute to see if there's any sum up you want to do, final lessons before we close out. Then I know he's going to be at the back table. We'll be selling books and he'll be signing them as well. So Clément?
Pay attention to what happens in France tomorrow on May 1st. And be proud of what is going on in this city and what will go on in this city for the next months and years and probably probably decades, because I think this is really a unique moment and it's, you know, a great opportunity, a great moment to be in Chicago and to be active in Chicago politics.
All right, great. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.